This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be shifting to another international topic. We'll be talking about recent events, current events in India. India and Pakistan have been rivals ever since 1947, ever since independence and partition. Over the past few years, both of these governments have been working to try to improve relations, although progress has been slow. In this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about where that stands, and it seems always the place, almost always the place one begins when you're talking about either India or Pakistan, that is the relationship with the other country. But we'll also talk about a number of things, including concerns that India has about terrorism, and also efforts that the Indian government has been making to try to include India's poor in the country's economic growth. And our guest for this part of Focus 580 is Sumit Ganguly. He is Rabindranath Tagore Professor of Indian Cultures and Civilizations and also Professor of Political Science at Indiana University and is interested in India and Pakistan and security issues involving that part of the world. He has authored a couple of books that you might be interested in. His most recent is Conflict Unending, India-Pakistan Tensions Since 1947. He's also recently published another looking at Kashmir. That book is The Crisis in Kashmir, Portents of War, Hopes of Peace. He's been with us before on this program, and we're pleased that he could be joining us once again. He's talking with us on the telephone, and as we talk, questions are welcome from people who are listening. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. And the toll-free line, that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if people who are listening have questions, you want to be involved in the conversation, just pick up the telephone and give us a call. Professor Ganguly, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us once again.
My pleasure, entirely.
As I said, I think probably any time you talk about either India or Pakistan, there are a number of things that you could discuss, but it seems that always one begins with the relationship between the two countries. And as I said, and I think that it's true, and you can expand on this, that in recent years, both governments have been making attempts at improving relations, but it seems to be something that moves in fits and starts. Things go along, there seems to be a little bit of progress, then something happens to set things back. And perhaps the most recent setback was back in July when there were a series of terrorist bombings in Mumbai. And the chief suspects here were Islamic groups based in Pakistan. Apparently, there are also some people who feel that perhaps even Pakistan's intelligence apparatus was involved. But it was a very serious attack. A lot of people were killed. And again, it caused significant tension between the two countries. Since then, I think that the two leaders have said, we want to work together to deal with this problem. But it's still obviously things are very difficult. Can you just talk a little bit about, in general terms, perhaps, about how things stand today between the governments of India and Pakistan?
The progress in terms of the talks have really been glacial. Even though both sides have expressed a willingness to talk, the Bombay bombings still loom very large on the horizon. And there have been allegations from the police chief in Bombay that these highly orchestrated attacks could not have been carried out without external support. And allegations have been made at fairly high levels that external support came from Pakistan. And so while there have been discussions between General Pervez Musharraf, the military ruler of Pakistan, and the Prime Minister Manmohan Singh about trying to improve, about finding ways to improve relations, and also the possibility of cooperation against terrorism, of joint cooperation against terrorism, actually on the ground there has been little or no movement. And in large part it's because of the extraordinary suspicions about Pakistan's involvement or likely involvement in the Bombay bombings.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think that if people, what they have said about the motivation for these bombings, it would seem that their purpose was, in fact, to disrupt any sort of conversation between the two countries.
That's one set of motivations. The other is a more sinister one, and that suggests that India is now really on a growth path, and India grew at 8.1% last year, making it the second fastest growing economy in the world after the People's Republic of China. And if India continues on the path of economic reform, and if the government can improve infrastructure to some degree, there is even talk amongst economists of exceeding the single-digit growth rate going into double-digit growth. And the argument that has been made by some people in India that the orchestrated attack that took place in India's principal financial capital, Bombay, was not accidental. This came at a time when India's global stock is rising, largely fueled by its economic growth. And by making the financial capital look insecure, unsafe, threatening, dangerous, it was an attempt to somehow darken India's international image as a safe place to invest. This is the second line of argument that has been advanced by some people.
Well, that's interesting that it would have not only perhaps a political dimension, but it would also have an economic dimension as well.
There is no question about it that in the minds of some people that this clearly had an economic dimension because the attack did not come in New Delhi, India's political capital, or in Bangalore, which is the hub for informatics activity, but in Bombay, which attracts a significant amount of foreign investment and is also the financial epicenter of the country.
Certainly, this kind of rivalry, the tension between the two countries, goes all the way back to their creation. And it seems that on both sides here, there is, on the part of people in India and in Pakistan, very strong sense of identity, of national identity. There is a religious divide. And at the same time, that you would have to say that the both India and Pakistan do have a lot in common. In many ways, they're not that different, which makes you wonder whether there's ever any possibility that the commonalities will somehow come to outweigh this very strong sense of nationalism and identity that seems to keep the two countries up and the two peoples apart.
Actually, the commonalities are increasingly becoming few and far between. At one time, after independence, perhaps even after the first two decades of independence, indeed, there were many commonalities of language, of culture, of shared history, and the like. These are mostly beginning to fall apart for a number of compelling reasons. First, in terms of shared history. In Pakistan, the textbooks have been so designed by various military governments that it glorifies only the Islamic period of South Asian history and denigrates everything else. It is a very constructed history. It is a very selective reading of history. And unfortunately, at least a couple of generations of Pakistanis have been weaned on that history, which is in considerable discord with the actual history of the subcontinent. That's one very important theme to bear in mind. Secondly, the generation that of partition, people who went to Pakistan from what was United India and people who fled from what was going to become Pakistan into India, that generation, which had ties and a certain kind of nostalgia for their relatives, for their friends, for their communities, that generation has just about all passed away. The new generation of Indians and Pakistanis do not have this kind of nostalgia about each other because they have little or no contact with each other. And the two governments have not helped in terms of promoting people-to-people contacts. So that's the second reason why the commonalities have declined. And the third, which is very important to emphasize, is that India and Pakistan have had markedly different political trajectories. Pakistan has not had a single government that has been democratically elected which was allowed to serve out a full term. It's completely different in India, where governments routinely survive their full term, or if they lose an election, a opposition party comes to power, but this is done through normal democratic means. And there's a fourth distinction that one needs to bear in mind, is that the economic trajectories of the two countries are completely different. India, with its myriad problems, is growing at an extraordinarily rapid rate, and this is easily sustainable. The same cannot be said for Pakistan. So while the commonalities did exist for a considerable period of time after independence, they are increasingly beginning to fall apart.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Sumit Ganguly, is professor of Indian cultures and civilizations and also political science at Indiana University. And we're talking about politics in India, and questions and comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. India is a majority Hindu state, although in living within India, there are significant numbers of Muslims, and there have been on and off, perhaps all the way going back to the beginnings of the country and partition, tensions within India between Hindus and Muslims. Recently, that seems to have perhaps improved a little bit. Do you have any sort of sense that that is any less as a source of tension within India? That's any less than it's ever have been before, has been before?
It's slightly better given the complexion of the government, which is not interested in fomenting Hindu-Muslim tensions. Unlike the previous government led by the Bharatiya Janata Party, which in many ways was correctly construed by people both in India and abroad as having a somewhat hostile agenda when it came to India's 140 million strong Muslim community, that they were insensitive at best to the concerns of Muslims and downright hostile to the concerns of Muslims. And that certainly is not the case with the present government, and the relief amongst people in India who would like India to be a secular state is actually palpable. It's perceptible. As someone who travels to India on a regular basis and has conversations with people from all walks of life, it is quite evident that there is a perceptible difference between the conditions that Muslims faced and the climate, the political climate that Muslims faced under the BJP-led regime and now under the Congress-led regime. Mm. So things are better, and one hopes that India's secular status will be strengthened rather than weakened in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about another security issue that we're starting to hear more about, although this is not apparently something that is new, and that is the activity of Maoist groups within India. Security concerns in the past have centered on the kinds of issues that we have talked about, the relationship between India and Pakistan, and Kashmir as a particular flashpoint involving the two countries. And while that still is true, there is apparently in the central and eastern parts of India this Maoist movement. It's been going on now actually for a long time. Significant numbers of people are killed every year. But just recently it appears that this is getting worse. And in fact, that now some people are saying that I believe actually even the Prime Minister said something like this recently, that the Maoists now pose a greater threat to Indian security than do Kashmiri separatists.
If the Maoist threat is allowed to fester, yes, it could have very serious consequences for India's internal security. But I think the capability of the Indian state to suppress the Maoists still exists, and suppress using a mixture of coercion and co-optation, of using force against the Maoists and also bringing them into the political fold. India has successfully weathered a number of insurgencies in the past, and I am reasonably confident that India will rise to the challenge that the Maoists pose to internal security in India. Nevertheless, as the Prime Minister correctly pointed out, this is a problem that should not be allowed to fester. This is a problem that must be dealt with forthrightly, and it largely stems from considerable rural inequity that pervades certain parts of India and which the Maoists are capitalizing upon. But I don't think the Maoists offer any kind of a real solution or panacea to the ills that plague the countryside. Ultimately, it is the Indian state that will have to address these inequities and address the genuine grievances of poor rural people. The Maoists really do not have an answer, and the answers that they have would be much worse than anything that the Indian state has ever done or not done for its population.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, Maoists, I suppose it's true of Maoists anywhere, see themselves as being a rurally based kind of political effort, and that's where their strength and that's where their focus is. And that has been the case with these Maoists in India. I think also, though, some people raise this question, well, is there some possibility that they might escalate the struggle and take it up a notch and, in fact, become more active in urban areas? They might even take their armed struggle to some of India's cities.
That's certainly a legitimate fear, because that was the case when the first Maoist rebellion started in the early 1970s and the late 1960s in the state of West Bengal, in extreme eastern India, bordering what is present-day Bangladesh. That's where, in the tea gardens of West Bengal, where there was considerable inequity and hardship amongst the tea workers, which the Maoists successfully exploited. And then they ultimately took it to the capital of West Bengal, the city of Calcutta. And for a while, the city of Calcutta had been rendered virtually ungovernable until the state government took a very harsh stance against the Maoist rebels and ruthlessly suppressed them. So, yes, it is a possibility if this movement is allowed to grow, if it's not nipped in the bud, if both political and military means are not used simultaneously against the Maoists, that possibility does lurk, though I don't think there's any imminent danger thereof.
I wonder, the current government, it's a Congress Party government. They came to power in 2004, and I think that a lot of people felt that actually was a surprise. It was a bit unexpected, because previous to that, the BJP, the nationalist Hindu party, was in power for some significant amount of time. And I think a lot of people were surprised by the Congress Party win in 2004. And that had something to do with a lot of people feeling that they had not benefited from the kind of growth in India's economy that we've talked about, and we can get to that. But just as a general question, has the Congress Party government led by Mr. Singh taken a significantly different sort of direction from that of the previous BJP government?
Well, one of the things that's markedly different, of course, is the whole issue that we've already talked about, and so I'll just briefly mention it and then move on to the second theme. The first theme is that it has taken a markedly different view when it comes to minorities, and particularly the very large Muslim minority. It's taken a much more conciliatory stance towards the Muslim minority, has put Muslims in significantly powerful positions in office, and the like, and I think is not likely to foment Hindu-Muslim discord, which certain elements of the BJP quite mischievously did. And that's putting it mildly. On some occasions, they were even responsible for considerable violence against the Muslim community. The second theme is that the Congress has said that it will focus its efforts on rural development and has taken some steps in that direction, though not all of the steps that they have taken, in my judgment, make economic sense. They may make populist sense, but they don't make sound economic sense. But be that as it may, they have tried to address the questions of rural poverty, rural inequity, and the absence of rural infrastructure. But unfortunately, these are things that cannot be handled within the span of a couple of years. We are basically talking about decades of neglect, which have to be addressed. And what they have taken are the first incremental steps to address some of these deep-seated, well-entrenched problems. It will require a much longer period of time before we start seeing meaningful results.
Mm-hmm. And as you have mentioned, the Indian economy has been doing very well over the past few years. Over the last decade, the annual growth rate has been something between 6% and 8%. Annually. So it's booming, but not everyone has benefited. And again, as you say, that while perhaps middle-class people are doing well, there's still a lot of poverty, especially in rural areas. I was really struck by the statistic that I came across in one of the articles that I read, that 30% of the Indian population lives on less than a dollar a day, and 78% live on less than $2 a day. This particular issue and perhaps a growing divide between people who are doing well or well enough and people who are not, seems that this can only become more important in the future.
This is exactly right. According to the World Bank, 26% of the population lives below the official poverty line. That's about 260 million people, which is almost the total population of the United States. And that is a crying shame that almost 60 years after independence that India, despite its professed commitment for many, many years, for at least the first four decades, to some form of socialism, has not been able to make a more significant dent on rural and urban poverty. But if one wants to focus on the more positive side, the most recent figures I've seen suggest that India has a middle class of about 300 million people, which is, again, like the total population of the United States. So one can look at particular ends of the spectrum, but the point remains that unless one can lift these 260-odd million people out of the kind of grinding, degrading, dehumanizing poverty that they face, much of India's economic growth will really benefit only a certain segment of the population. We must somehow find a way, India's policymakers must somehow find a way of reaching the bottom end of the ladder. You cannot really have a country that is stable and prosperous and moving ahead when a significant portion of the population cannot even eke out enough of a living to get two square meals a day. That is really intolerable in a democracy.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here where we are in Champaign County, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi. It seems that ruthless suppression of a class of people is probably the worst thing to do. You said be even-handed and do some things to perhaps help the plight of the tea workers in Assam or whatever. But I don't know. I just had a very strong reaction to that. Maybe you were speaking about the policy and not being prescriptive. But it seems to me, as far as the economics of India, some of the best figures for quality of life come from Kerala, which is not following the model that Congress seems to have embraced, the more privatization and less responsibility of the government for the condition of people. So I don't know how you want to react to that. What I actually wanted to talk about was U.S. India relations and the vote in this lame duck session on the aid to nuclear power, limiting the number of inspections to various arms-producing reactors in India. I'm very shocked to hear that Durbin is espousing this, and I urge my fellow citizenry to call Durbin and say don't do this, among all the other things that we're petitioning our senators who are now soon to be in power of some kind. So I don't know how you react to the India nuclear program. It seems to me that it's going to cause unintended reactions, or maybe intended reactions, in China, and that the better way to go is to somehow try to work towards demilitarizing, de-escalating across the India-Pakistan situation, or rather than, Pakistan has a new reactor, so we're giving money for India to have more reactors. I'll listen.
Okay, let me try. There's so many things in there. Let me try and address all three of them and try not to forget about anything. First of all, I said nothing about repressing tea workers. I was talking about the Indian state repressing the Maoists, the Naxalites, who were absolutely ruthless, brutal, and cruel, who killed university professors, who killed helpless policemen at traffic crossings, all in the name of class struggle. And very soon, the entire movement degenerated into nothing more than an extortion racket. My heart goes out to tea workers, since I have gone to tea gardens in Assam and West Bengal, and I have seen their continuing plight. Everything has to be done to organize these people, to give them proper labor rights, and to ensure that they are not exploited. But the Maoists certainly did not offer them a pathway out of their plight. The Maoists had their own vicious, cruel, and ultimately foolish agenda. Secondly, on Kerala, that model is not sustainable on a national basis. Kerala, in large part, the growth and the equity is sustained by massive infusions of money of Keralites who cannot find employment at home and go work in fairly execrable conditions in the Middle East, where there are no labor rights in the Persian Gulf, where you deal with squalid regimes who routinely exploit Indian workers, except the white-collar workers whom they dare not exploit because they lack their own human capital, so they rely on the Indians for doctors, for nurses, for teachers, and for a whole variety of other, for accountants, engineers, but they exploit the Indian laborers in the worst kind of way. And these poor people send in huge remittances into Kerala. Also, Kerala benefited from a particularly enlightened monarch and from Christian missionaries who had propagated literacy long before the end of British colonialism. So the Kerala model is sui generis. It cannot be replicated across India. There are peculiar historical and locational advantages that Kerala has. It cannot be done on a nationwide basis. Third, the Indian nuclear program has little or nothing to do with Pakistan acquiring reactors. We have punished India for a very long period of time because it refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, even though the Indians objected to the terms of the treaty even before it went into effect in 1970. India was one of the original proponents of the treaty, but felt that the treaty should be linked to the major powers which possess nuclear weapons to come up with a time-bound schedule for nuclear disarmament. Now, that might have been a pie in the sky, but the point remains that the Indian objections were stated from the very outset. We have punished India for all this period of time, have denied them technology. What has it accomplished? Did it stop India from building reactors? No. Did it stop India from crossing the nuclear Rubicon in 1998 and testing five nuclear weapons? No. A failed policy is not the way to continue our efforts. Instead, we should think of a more imaginative way by which we can engage India and actually manage to get 14 out of the 22 reactors that India has under full-scope IAEA safeguards. This, to me, is a great advance. And furthermore, if India can derive a certain amount of its power from nuclear energy, it will burn less coal, which will then not contribute to global climate change. So there are a number of compelling reasons why we should support this deal, whatever be our reservations about the Bush administration.
So I think the concerns, I would imagine the concerns of this caller and others, have to do with our interest in non-proliferation and in trying to keep a lid on any potential conflict and growth of nuclear weapons involving the two countries. Some people would say, well, that if that's our concern, that this this is perhaps not achieving that, and in fact that it's almost turning away from the Indians and their nuclear effort. It's not as if we're coming right out and sanctioning it, but it's also it's as if we have given up on the idea that we could use force to persuade them not to go down that path. And I think that some people say, well, isn't that really almost giving up on the idea of nonproliferation in this part of the world?
No, not really, for a couple of different reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, for 30 years we have sanctioned India. Did that achieve the results that we wanted? When the policy has failed for 30 years, do we want to pursue it for the next 30? I think I will give the administration credit in this arena of coming up with a more imaginative policy that might actually enable us to engage India and to enable us to improve radiation shielding, improve safety at India's nuclear power plants, and also contribute to India's ability to diversify its sources of energy, rely less on coal and on oil, because oil and coal are both finite resources, and Indian coal is very rich in sulfur, which contributes to the burning of which contributes to global climate change. So I think on this particular issue, I would give the administration credit for coming up with a policy which recognizes that the policy that we have doggedly pursued for the last 30 years has not accomplished anything. And secondly, unlike Pakistan, unlike North Korea, unlike Iran, India has an impeccable record of not proliferating. I will challenge anyone to provide me evidence that India has disseminated nuclear technology to states that it should not be dealing with. On the contrary, there is evidence reported in the New York Times, no less, that on certain occasions, both Libya and Iran approached India for nuclear technology and was rebuffed on both occasions.
In the past, Pakistan has been an important ally for the United States in this region, and still in a technical sense, I suppose it is. And yet at the same time, I would imagine there are people in Washington that are thinking, well, that relationship's never going to be stronger than it is now, and it could be in the future significantly weaker. We need to have an ally in this region. And perhaps for that reason, there are more people saying that it makes sense for us to try to strengthen our ties with the government of India, if for no other reason than for that reason, and also because I think we can expect in the future that India is going to become an increasingly powerful player on the world stage economically and perhaps politically as well.
Actually, we should start disassociating India from Pakistan for the simple reason that the trajectories of these two countries are completely different. India is growing at 8.1% without any kind of assistance. Pakistan's growth rate this year will be about 6%, and in large part it's dependent upon massive infusions of money from the Middle East through Pakistani expatriate workers, Pakistanis abroad who are putting in their money in Pakistani banks, and American economic assistance. That's what's giving this 6% growth rate in Pakistan. Secondly, Pakistan and India have two completely different political systems. Democracy in India is firmly embedded. And I'll even say this, that the fiasco that happened in Florida has not happened in India in the last 50 years. India has a uniform voting system based upon electronic voting machines. They don't continue to have the kinds of problems that dog us. So, we need to recognize the singular achievement of Indian democracy, something that Pakistan has failed to achieve in the most miserable fashion. Thirdly, Pakistan has been a very shaky ally. It is far from clear that General Musharraf is cooperating with us in a fulsome fashion in terms of trying to eviscerate the al-Qaeda and to ensure that the remnants of the Taliban are successfully suppressed. So we need to sort of start separating this conversation. We should not be talking about India and Pakistan anymore in the same breath. No, I think the United States is courting India for other reasons. One, for the very significant market that's emerging in India. Two, because India is becoming a major military power in Asia. Three, India's own diplomacy has changed very dramatically. India no longer has this kind of neuralgic attitude of constantly criticizing the United States for all manner of real and imagined grievances. India is becoming much more cooperative, much more willing to work with us to achieve common ends. And this preceded the Bush administration. And it has continued through the Bush administration and will continue, in my view, after the Bush administration passes from the scene. So I think the reasons for cooperating with India have little or nothing to do with Pakistan.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Sumit Ganguly. He's professor of Indian cultures and civilizations and political science at Indiana University and has written for all of the various professional journals in the political science field that deal with foreign affairs and Asian politics. He's also author of the books A Conflict Unending, India-Pakistan Tensions Since 1947, and The Crisis in Kashmir, Portents of War, Hopes of Peace. He's joining us this morning by phone. We have some other callers here, and we'd welcome others into the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a couple of Urbana callers. We'll go next to line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. One comment about Indian coal. Indian coal is not high in sulfur. In fact, it is much lower in sulfur than what we have in the United States. India's coal problem is different. It has more ash, which reduces its value as a fuel. But nonetheless, it's a different issue. The issue with coal is carbon dioxide emissions, and that's why India is trying to go in the direction of nuclear. That raises a different problem, and that is how far India is going to benefit from this nuclear deal, because any kind of nuclear reactor takes a decade or more to build. The second issue here is the technology that United States can deliver. Because no nuclear power plant has been built in this country for nearly 25 years. So from the point of view of India, this policy of engagement has to be also looked at as a policy of engagement in order to contain. And that's basically the same type of policy that China seems to follow vis-a-vis India. And I'm wondering if you have any points of view as to whether India stands to really benefit from this deal, or is it going to surrender much more of its political sovereignty in the long run without really getting any benefits, at least not in the next 10 to 20 years. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Actually, I stand corrected about the sulfurous content of coal. It's actually the bituminous content of coal that's the problem in India. But the point is still the same, that it contributes to global climate change. The ultimate outcome is not different, whether it's sulfur or whether it's bituminous content. The point is still the same. India needs to reduce its reliance on coal if it is not going to be one of the major contributors to CO2 emissions. On nuclear power, 3% of India's energy needs are currently met by nuclear power. If this deal goes through, yes, there is a certain gestation period involved in building nuclear power plants, but all the estimates that I've seen from perfectly reliable people suggest that up to about 12% of India's energy needs could be met by nuclear energy if indeed this deal goes through. And no, there is this is simply a canard that has been propagated primarily and ironically by the extreme left and the extreme right in India, that India is about to surrender its sovereignty. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh might have made various mistakes, as any of us are capable of making, but there is no question in my mind that he's a staunch Indian nationalist. and under no circumstances would he surrender India's sovereignty or independence to the United States. This kind of an allegation against one of India's most thoughtful, honest, and extraordinary prime ministers is really an unfortunate one. And one should not make these allegations unless there is clear-cut evidence. This is mostly based upon fears and misinformation rather than any clear-cut evidence. There is no evidence whatsoever that India is surrendering its sovereignty to the United States or anyone else. And on a final point, once these sanctions are lifted, India is at liberty to purchase reactors from France, which derives a significant portion of its energy from nuclear power since it has little or no coal left and has no oil whatsoever. It could also purchase reactors from the Soviet Union, from the former Soviet Union, Russia, which has considerable experience in reactor technology, and from other countries like Germany. It is not limited to purchasing reactors from Westinghouse.
We go on. Let's talk with someone also in Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Yes, good morning. As a communist, I'd like to ask you what you think the specific gravity of the Communist Party hyphen Marxist, the dominant party in West Bengal, is, and to some extent Kerala, on the overall influence of Indian politics, and to what extent is the struggle in Sri Lanka, or should we say Ceylon, on the influence of what's going on. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
The communists have a disproportionate influence on policy outcomes because in large part the present government is dependent upon the communist parties in parliament to get various pieces of legislation through because the Congress does not command a majority in parliament. And consequently, the communists, my judgment, have been a significant drag on policymaking because they have played a very obstreperous role. But that's, again, in my judgment, obstreperous. And as far as the conflict in Sri Lanka goes, it's almost completely indigenous at this point. It's between the Tamil minority and a very violent segment of the Tamil minority led by the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, which is a group that has long resorted to terror. But there are long historical antecedents, and it has to do with systematic discrimination and particularly linguistic discrimination against the Tamils by the Sinhala majority, which ultimately led some of the Tamils to resort to violence and ultimately terror. But there are lots of moderate Tamils who probably would still agree to some sort of a political settlement. The unfortunate thing is the LTTE doesn't seem to be capable of coming to the negotiating table.
All right. Well, we go on again to someone in Urbana Line 1. Hello.
Hi. I've been invited to West Bengal to give a presentation on electronic books, and I have some questions because I did a couple of test presentations here to audiences, primarily from India, and found absolutely no interest in this. So I need some help here.
I'm happy to be of help, except you may not like my answer, I fear, because most Indians are still wedded to the idea of old-fashioned books. Of things you can hold and feel and curl up on your couch with. It's hard to imagine curling up with a laptop on one's couch and reading from it. And furthermore, you have to understand that only a small fraction of India's population are affluent enough to be able to read books electronically. And consequently, the market is relatively small.
We're giving them away for free and hoping to give away the readers for free. I realize we're running out of time. Is there any way I could email you to talk to you more about
this? You may absolutely do so, and I will offer you any help that I can. And since it's my home state, I have a particular interest in helping you.
How can I get in contact
with
you?
Oh, it's very simple. It's S, the letter S, and then Ganguly, G-A-N-G-U-L-Y, at indiana.edu.
Okay, sorry, do that again.
S. Ganguly, S as in Sam, Ganguly, G-A-N-G-U-L-Y, at indiana.edu.
Okay, S-G-A-N-G-U-L-Y,
at indiana.edu.
Got it?
Got it?
Sorry, I got cut off for a second, so I didn't hear your reply.
No, is it yes? Yes, you got it. I believe you have it correct.
Okay, sorry, I got lost. I didn't get the yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Ganguly at indiana.edu.
That's correct.
Thank you very, very much.
All
You're
right.
welcome.
Well, thanks for the call. And again, we have a few minutes left. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Sumit Ganguly. He's professor of Indian cultures and civilizations and a professor of political science at Indiana University. Just as you touched a little bit on something that I want to talk about here, we have a couple of minutes left, and that is we have talked about the fact, and it has come up on other conversations, certainly, that India's economic growth means that it is becoming increasingly powerful player on the world stage, economically speaking. And I think, again, if people think about those countries that are poised to grow even further and become very, very significant, India is one of it's in there with the countries that are usually mentioned. Brazil, India, China, Russia are the ones. Is the way that India is thinking about being involved in the world other than economically changing? And I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, for such a long time, well, it was one of the founders of the non-aligned movement, and that had a certain kind of political orientation. Are they, as far as their involvement in the rest of the world, in a kind of political sense, changing the way that they are thinking and seeing perhaps a different kind of role for India in the future?
Most definitely. And there is an interesting debate about this in India. Just as there is a debate about the economic model that India is pursuing, similarly, it's mirrored in the foreign policy arena. There's a very important debate in the foreign policy arena about the direction that India is pursuing, whether or not it should still try to be a leader of the dispossessed in this world of the third world and oppose the United States and the advanced industrialized states, because there are differences on issues of trade and global equity and the like, or should it increasingly recognize that it should adopt a more flexible policy on occasion, supporting the interests of the weaker and the poor, economically weaker countries in the world, the poorer countries in the world, and on occasion when it suits India's interests, to make common cause with the advanced industrialized societies. Because India has its feet in both worlds. India at one level is a highly complex industrialized society, and at another level, India also, as we have discussed in this hour, is a very poor country. And so on occasion, its interests diverge. And the trick is not to become completely wedded to one position or other, but to develop a flexible, pragmatic kind of foreign policy that best serves India's interests rather than an ideological one that actually hurt India during much of the Cold War years.
Hmm. Do you think that it does indeed make sense to put India in that group with those other nations when you think about their potential? And here we're talking about a couple of decades, but 20, 30 years as a very significant economy and perhaps not as strong as the United States, perhaps not as strong as all of Europe together, but very strong indeed.
There's no question about it. If India can address three issues, I can see India growing at a phenomenal rate and sustained over an extended period of time. One is energy, which we have talked about at some length. Second is India has to reform its labor laws and make its labor laws much more flexible to generate more employment for people. And third is India has to improve its creaking educational infrastructure, perhaps the subject of another conversation later on. If it can address these three bottlenecks, and maybe a fourth, and that is infrastructure, which already it's beginning to tackle and has tackled to some degree, particularly in the area of telecommunications, where there has been a fundamental breakthrough. If it can address some of the issues of infrastructure and the three other things that I mentioned over the course of the next decade or so, I see an extraordinarily prosperous future for India, because it has many of the other requisites for economic growth.
One, just going back again to something we've talked about at the beginning, was this real challenge that the government is facing to try to bring some of the benefits of this growth that we have talked about to the poor people of India, which is the substantial percentage of the population, particularly rural people. The government has been involved in a program trying to deal with rural poverty, essentially where they're creating federally funded jobs. Maybe not an enormous kind of amount of money here we're talking about, but significant for the people who have it, a significant improvement. Is that a program that has had some success?
No, I'm afraid not. I'm a dissenter on that. I think it's very well-meaning, but as the finance minister put it the other day, he said, you do not repair a leaky pipe by increasing the water pressure. And I thought that was a wonderful metaphor. Much of the money will not reach the intended targets in terms of the rural population. A lot of it will be siphoned off by local notables. This has been the tragedy of many of these make-work programs in India. And you're not imparting real skills to the population. I would spend that money on educational infrastructure in India. I would spend that money on rural healthcare in India rather than spending that money simply trying to create work which do not impart any skills, because all you're doing is absorbing a certain amount of manual labor. People who, tar roads using fairly primitive technology, and those roads after the next monsoon are washed away because they have not been properly built, because these people are not skilled laborers. There are other ways of ensuring income transfers and alleviating rural poverty rather than these kinds of income transfers, which more often than not are eaten up by local politicians and local notables, and the really afflicted population does not stand to benefit.
Well, there we must leave it with our thanks to our guest, Sumit Ganguly, Rabindranath Tagore Professor of Indian Cultures and Civilizations and Professor of Political Science at Indiana University. Professor Ganguly, thank you very much.
My pleasure entirely.